Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. Jim Browdy and Jared Bowen sitting in for Marjorie. And they say good things come to those who wait. In King Richard III's case, that meant 530 years. He died in battle in 1485. In 2012, his remains were discovered underneath a modern parking lot. And this Thursday, he'll finally get a farewell fit for medieval royalty. Here with us in Studio 3 to distinguish the man from the myth is Nancy Kane. Nancy is an historian at the Harvard Business School, where she holds the James E. Robison Chair of Business Administration. Her latest book is Ernest Shackleton, Exploring Leadership. Hey there, Nancy.
Hey there.
Hey, Nancy. I love this story. This is so exciting. Richard III, who many of us have this less than kind, shall we say, image of him from Shakespeare. There's breaking news on the Richard III front after 530 years. What is that breaking news?
The breaking news is that his body was found. Most likely it was buried very quickly by monks after the very famous Battle of Bosworth Field in the very late 15th century, mid-1480s, and then a writer who is also a devout member, listen to this, dear listeners, of the Richard III Society, founded in 1924 as a kind of, you know...
Let's rehabilitate his image
and get away from the evil character that Shakespeare portrayed him as, 1924. And a writer named Philippa Langley, who was working on a book on the king, got interested in where his bones might be, was convinced they were in what had been a priory, part of a monastery, outside of Leicester in the Midlands of England, and basically raised $250,000. This is what she spent her time doing, and to basically fund an archaeological dig. And they started digging, archaeologists and some scholars from the University of Leicester, and lo and behold, they found a spine, a skeleton, the remains, no shroud, no coffin, but the skeleton of someone they believed was Richard III. They then did DNA testing on it with descendants of Richard III's sister, one of whom was in Canada, one of whom was in England, and lo and behold, the results came back positive. He has a curved spine.
As described in Shakespeare,
probably didn't have quite the hunchback or the limp, the real king, as Shakespeare's character does. And now, this was all discovered in the last 2 years, and now this Sunday, they had a proper procession and funeral parade to which 35,000 people came, according to the Times. That's more than came for the 60th anniversary of Queen Elizabeth's reign or taking up the throne in the mid-1950s. And, you know, the Richard III Society folks are waving their flags. Finally, he is having a burial. He will be buried in the Leicester Cathedral, fit for a king,
so to speak. And by the way, when 35,000 doesn't sound like that much, it's 35,000 out of only 300,000 people live in Leicester. It's more than 10%. And by the way, my favorite part about, I think it was the same person you mentioned, when the DNA test came back positive, the woman you're talking about says, we went very quiet, then did a little dance in the laboratory.
Exactly.
Before we talk, return to current events and the rediscovery of his body 500 years later and arguably the rehabbing of his reputation. For those who were not familiar with how he was portrayed, there is nothing horrible enough that could have been said about him. My recollection, please correct me if I'm wrong, purely from Shakespeare, because I am no historian, is killed both his nephews. I think, didn't he kill his wife so he could marry his niece or something? He was a venal character.
In Shakespeare's Richard III, the longest or semi-longest of Shakespeare's plays, vying for Hamlet, depending on which version from which folio we're talking about. In that play, the protagonist kills his nephews, which are the sons of his brother. They're the ones due to ascend the throne. It's his brother, Edward IV, who's king. He kills his brother, the next brother in line, Clarence.
Oh, I forgot
that.
He
kills Clarence. He kills his wife to marry another woman because he thinks that'll help legitimate his place on the throne. And he kills a bunch of other people, and it's a play that is literally in gorgeous poetry or gorgeous prose, you know, just a litany of evil, of evil deeds.
Yeah, because how did he kill the brother? In a barrel of wine.
And he drowns him in a barrel of wine, and, you know, he takes these two young boys and locks them up in the tower, and they are never seen again. In the play, it's clear he kills them. In history, in the historical record, which is not conclusive, but on balance, the evidence suggests the real Richard III probably did have his nephews disappeared, shall we say. And so that the you know, Shakespeare's character is about as evil and in a strange kind of House of Cards-like way. I think Kevin Spacey once said he partly modeled, right, Frank Underwood on Richard III.
Is that true?
That is the grapevine.
I love that. Well, I don't care if it's true. I love it anyway.
Well, the idea that you play any card you can, no pun intended, to keep your power or to augment it, fits with the series. And undoubtedly, Spacey has played Richard III. Almost all great actors have. It's considered one of the most desirable parts on the stage. In any event, the play is about just, you know, venality in every way, shape, or form, emanating from Richard. And it has a kind of lasciviousness to it that many of our listeners will recognize. He is a little bit greasy-lipped, both about his sexuality with women and and about the violence that his hands and his lips bring forth. The real Richard III probably wasn't that evil by some measure, whether he was a kind of paragon of justice and early reforms for the British monarchy as it moved out of the medieval period and into the Tudor period. Dear listeners, the king that takes the throne from Richard III after he's killed in 1485 is Henry VII, the father of Henry VIII. And so a whole new game begins. But whether he was as good as his very, very devoted fans, his groupies in the Richard III Society maintain, I think is a much more open question.
And by the way, before we leave Shakespeare, Shakespeare is sort of the exclamation mark at the end of that sentence of all these evil deeds. Is he was too horrible looking for even, what is it, for dogs to bark at or whatever.
Right.
So every horrible thing he could say about what he did, how he behaved, how he looked, Shakespeare said. You know, when you mentioned the finding of the body under this modern park, I just love this story. 500 and some years later, dedicated to this thing. They also learned a lot about, including about how he died and what he died with. I never heard this term. The weapon that was allegedly used was a halberd, H-A-L-B-E-R-D, which is a long pole with an axe-like thing at the end. And apparently all kinds of horrible things were done to him. This is true, apparently, including his body was dragged naked through the city before it was thrown into this unmarked grave, right?
Right. So what the best evidence and examination of his remains reveal is that he was probably killed with this axe-like halberd?
Halberd, I think.
Halberd to the back of his skull, almost severing his skull. And then it looks like there were a number of wounds probably made after he was dead that were some kind of humiliation wounds. Stabs to his buttocks, right? Stabs in other parts of his face, in parts
Look
of his face.
Look at Jared's face as you're describing this.
And something like, you know, the guards at Golgotha poking, right? Poking Christ and the robbers on either side of him. Again, in humiliation, they believe his hands were tied and his body was thrown naked over a horse and paraded through the town and then quickly kind of picked up by the monks and buried hastily. So this was not, you know, this was not the ending befitting a monarch. But you must remember, dear listeners, this was in the midst of 50 to 60 years of civil war that goes under the moniker the War of the Roses. Different aristocrats, many of whom had a claim to the throne through different kinds of lineage, basically duking it out for power. And so when Richard III was killed, he was killed in no uncertain way with no uncertain signaling about what this represented.
So this Richard III Society, I'm sure they're not fond of the Shakespeare portrait because what it's done. But at the same time, would we even know who Richard III was? Would we have this sense of him without Shakespeare?
I wouldn't.
No, I don't think we would have. I mean, he didn't reign for very long, dear listeners. He reigned for just a couple of years. And he reigned in the midst of all these changeovers of power that began all the way back, really, in the late 14th century with Richard II, who and his throne being taken by Henry IV, and then Henry V, and then Henry VI, and he's out, and then he's back in again, and then Edward IV. I mean, with that kind of turnover, shall we say, the revolving door of power during that century in England, and with very little stability, social or political, in the monarchy, and even in Parliament, I think he could very easily have slipped through the file folder cracks, right, in the large drawer of history. Shakespeare gets a lot of credit for Richard III.
We're talking to Nancy Kane about something I can't believe we're talking about, but it is actually a great historical mystery. Nancy Kane from Harvard Business School. You know, the two parts that really intrigue me is I love the Richard III Society and their relentlessness to not only find him, but to rehab him. And secondly, it's sort of, I can't remember the guy's name. The guy was Secretary of Labor for Ronald Reagan, who was indicted and then got off. And what was the famous line? He said, "Where do I go? Where does a man go to get his reputation back?" I mean, that's essentially what's happening to Richard III here. So what I don't understand historically, Nancy Kane, is, was his image, he being Richard III, beginning to get rehabbed? And we'll talk about the good things he allegedly did in a second. Prior to the discovery of his body in 2012, or did it all coincide? They found him, they DNA'd him, they identified him, and then all of a sudden the focus began to be on how accurate the historical picture was. What's the sequence of events?
It's the latter. So I think probably at Richard III Society conferences, like, you know, conferences for the reenactment of the Revolution or the Bronte Society, something I've belonged to for years and years and years.
How great are these people?
Exactly.
Come on, go ahead.
You know, exactly. I mean, you know, you go to the conference every year, a couple times a year, and you have these meetings and reenactments, and boy, you have drunk the Kool-Aid and you are on board understanding this particular person, or in the case of the Brontes, this sister of this family, these sisters that were writers. And but it's a small kind of bubble-like world, right? It's a little ecosystem, right, in a much larger ecosystem. I get the sense that that was what was going on with the Richard III Society. I studied English history. I wrote my first book about English history. I read a field in medieval English history. Right, had not thought a lot about Richard III until his bones were exhumed, right? And then the media gets interested. Richard III Society people can come forth and offer the gospel according to this much maligned king, and we can go forth with greater knowledge about the revisions on Shakespeare's character, which is the way many of us know this king.
So, but here's the fascinating thing. When he wasn't killing his wife and drowning his brother in a barrel of wine, he was actually creating...
And making his nephews disappear. Yeah. Don't forget that.
Disappearing them. The nephews, right. He was responsible. He was creating a large part of what we tout in our justice system today, especially here in America. How do you reconcile the two, and what did he do?
So what Jared's referring to, dear listeners, is some interesting evidence brought forth, I think, or made public and publicized by the Richard III Society about Richard III being interested in conducting what were called assizes, literally traveling courts at which the king often presided, where common people could bring grievances, right? You know, divorce proceedings, you stole my cow, you've stepped over my fence and your field.
And the king presided over these local things often?
You bet the king did.
So the common person got to argue his or her case or complaint before the king
probably
of England?
A nobleman of some form, right?
Actually, but
argued
the case.
Argued the case on behalf of someone that was under their protection, right, in front of the king. Absolutely. Wow. The king's courts, the royal courts, right, which is why when you see royal movies, you see the royal personage and the whole court moving to grand houses. That was not just because we got restless at Windsor. Right, it was, or Hampton Court. It was because there was business to be conducted, and a huge amount of that business was what we would call today judicial. So, according to the Richard III Society and some scholarship, but by no means all, dear listeners, I spent several hours last night with my English history books and some other journal articles. According to some accounts, Richard III was absolutely focused on bringing justice, including having honest people as jurors, bringing a more legitimate justice and democratizing justice. I think that's a bit of a stretch from the historians that I can get a good handle on. I think he probably did have something to do with what today we would call generally judicial reform. But it's at such a point in the early stages of this that we wouldn't recognize it from a modern standpoint. And you know, he was there for 2 years. Most of the time, he was busy fending off threats to his authority. I don't think this was someone who was really pushing the boundaries of democratic justice. I think that's overstating it. And there are lots and lots of reputable historians who would agree with that.
Is this part, or full disclosure, I'm part of the Richard III?
By the way, I choose to believe it, whether you do or not. As a former legal services lawyer, it sounds like he almost created the system in which I operated 500 years before I did it. So let's get back to why this moment was the moment. Even if you say there's some doubt as to the rehabbing of his reputation, how legit it was that he was this critical justice reformer, how did we begin to learn that once his body was exhumed and not know anything of it for the five centuries before?
We did. We did. I mean, the
But just no one cared till they found his bones?
Well,
is that what it was?
No. There. I mean, there... I'm a historian. There are always.
I know what you are.
There are always historians toiling away in dusty archives that know lots and lots of stuff. Whether it bubbles up to the surface of kind of collective interest or consciousness is a very separate
issue.
Right. And the kind of evidence that we're talking about, it's not like someone discovered a tranche of new papers from court proceedings in 1482. We're all working from the same very scanty basis of written evidence. So how that's interpreted and how a historical figure is regarded is really very subject to the prevailing winds of opinion and what we call in the academy revisionism. And Richard's having a warm, soft glow, kind of fuzzy lens moment. And, I don't see anything terribly surprising in that, but we want to be careful about not kind of swinging the pendulum all the way over to one side or the other when the evidence, there's no new evidence that suggests that somehow this was a great judicial reform.
So, Nancy, you are an historian. Why is it that people are just galvanized by this story? Why more people will show up for Richard III than the living queen who comes to their town? You had two towns, Leicester and York, fighting over where he would be buried. Right. There's now going to be a visitor center where he's buried next to the cathedral, so you can buy your Richard III placemats and magnets after you view the body and the site of the remains. There's a hologram that will outline where the body was actually found.
That's
beneath his parking lot.
Yeah.
Why? What about it galvanizes
people? A couple of things. First, I think a lot of it is just our fascination with military valor and royal personage. That's a seductive combination.
I believe he was the last king
to die in
battle. Yeah.
Right? And so there's something very appealing about that. I believe, dear listeners, please tell me if I'm wrong, that Benedict Cumberbatch has just recently completed a movie as Richard III, and where the last grand scene is, my horse, my kingdom for horse, because supposedly in Shakespeare's play, those are some of the closing lines. If he had a horse, he might have been saved from the halberd. There's a wonderful New Yorker cartoon, dear listeners, with a horse sitting in the witness box and an attorney saying, so you had every reason to suppose that you would receive a kingdom. In any event, I think there's something about battle and kings. And then, of course, we're always fascinated when something emerges from the past that we had no idea was there. So I think it's very curious that the Times has devoted four or five stories to this at some length. That says something about America's interest in the monarchy. But again, I think there's this combination of battle, king, mystery person, revising Shakespeare. And let's not forget the zealous efforts of these very, very, vocal pilgrims from the Richard III Society.
Absolutely. I want to talk one more minute about them in a second. But, beyond the DNA thing, one of the other things, one of the Times stories said, which was great, is that, for example, they found in his stomach, or what remained of his stomach, the residue of meat and other things that only the privileged few in those. So, every part of this mystery is just exciting. What did you say you belong to? The Emily Bronte Society?
The Bronte Society.
So what do people do there? I'm sorry.
Take that note of condescension out of your voice, Jim.
And can we, because the only thing missing from the story is a better, which I think they failed at, other than that one quote that we did, a little dance in the lab, is they didn't do enough description of who these people are.
Yeah.
So who goes to the Bronte Society and why?
So we're much smaller than the Richard III Society. It's a society of writers and academics and just people who are nuts about Wuthering Heights, Jane Eyre, The Professor, these wonderful, Villette, Shirley, these wonderful books, The Tenant of Wineveld Hall that Anne Bronte wrote. People that are nuts about the books and nuts about, again, like Richard III, the kind of, visual and romantic sense of these women toiling away on the moors to write these novels and then sending them off to their publishers under pseudonyms that implied they were men. It's just the writing of the books, as well as the story of the writers, is the grist of another novel, just like Richard III dying in battle, right, and then his bones getting dumped in his remains getting dumped in a priory by the monks. It all has it's all like a great Danielle Steele book. And I think we're all interested. There's something mysterious and seductive and fascinating about the past when we think of it in those kind of terms. what we do, what the Bronte Society does is hold conferences, right? Often, you know, revisit issues that are not very well understood, including some issues that many of us would not think are so important as, you know, the role of keeper, the dog in the Bronte household. I mean, we go to all kinds of lengths to try and understand their lives. But really, it's no, I don't think, so different from the Civil War or the Revolutionary War reenactments, where people are fascinated with a piece of the past and they just stay on it.
Do you get dressed up like one of the Brontes when you go to the thing?
I have never done that. But a good friend of mine from Harvard who taught literature with me named her dog Keeper after the Bronte stock.
Oh, my goodness. Well, Nancy Kane, thanks for helping us unfold this great mystery. This is great. It really was great. Nancy, good to see you.
All right. Nancy Kane joins us every Tuesday for Open Mic. Nancy Kane is an historian at the Harvard Business School, where she holds the James E. Robison Chair of Business Administration. Her latest book is Ernest Shackleton, Exploring Leadership. And you can also catch Nancy again tonight with Jim at 7 o'clock on Greater Boston.
Yes.
Nancy, thanks so much for joining us. And up next, if 34 degrees outside doesn't say spring, what about having the Big Apple Circus back in town? Ringmaster John Kennedy Kane, presuming no relation to you, Nancy Kane, is here with a preview of their 37th season. Stay tuned to 89.7 WGBH Boston Public Radio.